So as I said, we're picking up in Daniel chapter 4. The way the chronology here works out, we went through the first three chapters, and then we take a pause. And remember, Daniel and his friends were taken captive first. That was the first wave of captivity. And then what happened next is Ezekiel and his the congregation with him were taken captive over to the river Kibar. And so we walk away from Daniel for a moment, chronologically, about that time. We come over to Ezekiel and we see really all the history that takes place in the book of Ezekiel. And at the end of the book of Ezekiel, what we're left with is the temple's been destroyed, you know, Jerusalem has been destroyed, that third wave of captivity has happened. And what we're left with is the hope of the return to captivity. When we come back to Daniel, what we're going to see this evening is chapters 4 and 5 tell us of the remainder of that period of captivity. And we get on into chapter 6, and now we're into really the period of the return. So Daniel, even though it's a shorter book, covers a much larger span of time than Ezekiel's. That's one of the confusing things about the Bible sometimes. You know, when you've got a shorter book, you assume it covers less time, but that's not necessarily the case. And what we'll see is between, you know, just a couple of chapters, there might be a lot of history taking place, and that certainly is the case in the book of Daniel. So I'll try to walk us through that in a way that we'll be able to keep up with where we are in the timeline. I certainly appreciate Michael taking the last couple of classes. It's difficult when you're trying to cover a book like Ezekiel. Ezekiel's already a difficult book with lots of difficult passages and language. It's a long book, and we were just giving it a couple of classes. And so you think about, you know, how are you going to do that? And my suggestion is just don't show up and let someone else do it for you. Seems to be a pretty effective way to do that. But I certainly do. I got to listen to the lessons that he presented, and I appreciate the effective way that he presented that material. As I say, when we leave off there, there's a hopefulness. There's also a hopefulness that looks not just to the remnant returning, but as he describes that perfect temple, he's looking on to the remnant that is ultimately fulfilled in the church. And that's where we really leave off there in the book of Ezekiel. Well, coming back to Daniel chapter 4, we've gone through those opening stages of the relationship between Daniel and his friends and Nebuchadnezzar. And now we come to a place that seems later on in time in the reign, and at a time when Daniel has been rather exalted among all of the wise men that Nebuchadnezzar has in his employ. And we open up the chapter, and Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And it's a dream that disturbs him. Now, what is the nature of the dream? What does he see? Tree. He sees a giant tree, and then what happens to the tree? It's cut down, its branches are cut down and cast off to the side, and there's a stump left. And what's to happen to the stump? Do what? Okay. And what is it exposed to? The elements. It's exposed to the elements. And then it gets pretty interesting because it says the stump will be given the heart of an animal, not the heart of a man, which you're like, okay, well, all right. You can see that it's getting more pointed here. It's not so vague, even in the dream. Now, who is giving Nebuchadnezzar that information about what's happening to the tree, and at least to the extent that it goes, what all the meaning of that is? In the dream, someone, do what? Yeah, so a holy one came down from heaven and is explaining to some degree. Now, he's not giving him full explanation, but to some degree, he's explaining what's going on, and this idea of this is what will happen to the stump and so forth. So he wakes up. He goes through that same process that he's gone through before, asking his wise men to interpret the dream, and they cannot interpret it. And so he comes to Daniel once again. And I think Daniel's response to that dream is very instructive to us. So he asks Daniel, what about this dream? And how does Daniel, when he hears about this, how does he react? He's astonished and, yeah, he's he's disturbed. He's upset on behalf of the king. And it's sort of like when he hears this dream, he's like, oh no, I know what this means. And he says, who's going to be happy about this? Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar's enemies are going to be happy about this. Now, what is Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar? He's the most trusted counselor. What, from all that Daniel's come from and been through, what might we think Daniel would be to Nebuchadnezzar? I mean, do what? His right hand man. Okay. Yeah. What I'm getting at, is what I'm thinking, not what you're thinking, but what I'm thinking. He's got every reason to be his enemy. For Daniel to hate Nebuchadnezzar. Here's the man who's come in and destroyed Jerusalem. He is the enemy of Israel. This is the guy who carpet bombed your precious city. And he says to Nebuchadnezzar, I don't want this. I don't want to see this happen to you. And your enemies, not me, your enemies are going to be pleased by that. You would think Daniel would be among those people going, here it comes. All right. That's not his attitude at all. And in fact, how does he respond to Nebuchadnezzar? What does he plead with him to do? Yeah, to put away sin, practice righteousness, have some repentance. Please, please change directions here so that this doesn't happen to you. What's just been prophesied doesn't actually come to pass. And I think that sets a precedent. It gives us a pattern of behavior that I think is striking. The honor that he shows to the king, to a king that in so many ways has, I think, courted dishonor. And so here he continues to be a humble servant. Well, did the king repent? Chris? Yes. Well, and I think there's a tie-in to the root problem. I mean, at core, what is going to be, what's the problem? It's pride, okay? Now, that pride causes problems in two directions, all right? So Nebuchadnezzar disregards those who are higher than him, that is God, and he disregards those that are lower than him. That would be the poor and the helpless. And so in both directions, pride keeps you from paying attention and keeps you from being thoughtful about your position before God and before those who are less privileged in some way. And so, yes, you're right. It's very similar in some of the things the prophets have said. But it's also, I think, very telling because idolatry seems to be at the pinnacle of what God has to say to his people among the prophets. Pride seems to be the most consistent charge against other nations. And certainly that's included among God's people, but it seems to be most consistent to the other kings and so forth. Now, who is Nebuchadnezzar in God's plan upon his people? He has allowed Nebuchadnezzar to come in and destroy his house. Now, there's a real danger there. When you come in and you destroy that house, to think, what could Nebuchadnezzar think about himself and that God?
From my hands.
Right. And so he could have that arrogance. There's a lot of temptation for that arrogance. And I think Daniel recognizes that and points all that out. And please, please don't follow this path. Now, as to the repentance, do you think Nebuchadnezzar heeded Daniel's advice at all? I think there's a possibility that he listened to him some. Because it doesn't come immediately. There is a delay. Remember with Ahab that there's a delay, that Ahab showed some humility, and as a result, what had just been pronounced doesn't happen as soon as it was pronounced. It's delayed a little bit. So I think that's a possibility. Michael?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. And so maybe there is some appreciation of that. And it does seem that what happens is there's an instigation, right? So we go these 12 months, and it's not like he just continues right on down the path, but it's like there's this instigating moment. And what is that moment? What's Nebuchadnezzar doing when the judgment finally drops? looking out over those 80-foot thick walls and 160-foot high and saying, is this not the city that I have built for myself? Is this not Babylon, this great palace I have made for myself? And so he's just going around just appreciating his own grandeur out loud. And so it does seem that there's a provocation, like, you know, there's a distance between what Daniel says and then we go along and maybe there's a time to forget what Daniel says. And then there's this provocation to the Lord. And so judgment does come. And what does that look like in reality?
Right.
It's me, aren't I wonderful? And so what does it look like when God brings that judgment, that dream in reality? How does that take place? And what does that look like? I mean, what physically and so forth? I mean, how does it play out? Yeah. So he goes out and he eats grass and his hair grows out and looks like eagle's feathers and he's got fingernails growing out and he looks like somebody. He looks like an animal, right? I mean, that's what he begins to behave and look like. And so it gives us those descriptions saying that here's the man who has all of this majesty, who's maybe the most powerful man in the world. And where's the king? He's out there eating grass. And so it makes him look like a proper fool. And in his own eyes and in all the eyes of anyone who saw this. And he continued in that state until what happens? Yes, and it says in verse 36, at that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and my splendor were restored to me. And it's like, you know, that when I realized who God is, when I realized who, what my position before him was, then that's when I was restored. That's when I got back what I had lost. And how thoroughly does he recognize who God is? Yeah. And he does what he does and nobody is going to stand in his way. And so all the things that he might have thought about himself, he now says, no, that's God that's true about. That's not me. That's God. God is the one who plans things and does exactly what he plans to do. And nobody can turn his hand or get in his way of what he's doing. And he's in control. Ultimately, he's saying he's in control of me. Tony and then Michael. Yeah. I think about that in terms of, I was listening to Michael's lesson from Sunday, I think, and thinking about what sin and what the distortion does to you, you know, what you begin to believe, the foolish things that you begin to believe, right? And drawing Romans 1 into that, and we begin to believe lies and so forth. And so there's an element of craziness there, right? We begin to believe very foolish things. What would it be that would set that back in place? I'll tell you, one of the foundational things is knowing who God is will bring you to your senses. And so I think that even today that is a stabilizing factor. When we begin to become unstable in our thoughts, knowing who God is and who I am in relationship to him, that is a fundamental stabilizing factor. Michael? Right. Right. And we're going to see after he leaves the throne, the power vacuum does not stand still. And repeatedly gets taken over. Well, he is put back into his position of majesty and continues to rule, for some time. And as we close out chapter 4 and come into chapter 5, there's a lot of history that does take place. At the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, first of all, there's lots that happens. He goes down to Tyre. He makes more pursuits of Egypt. He continues as a military man and also continues to fulfill prophecy that God has already put in place. And so some of that is happening towards the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And then he ruled until 562. And when he dies, his son comes to the throne, and his name is Evil-Merodach, and that's not the same word evil that we would use, but that's nevertheless, that's his name. And he only reigned 2 years and was assassinated. And so then his brother-in-law succeeded him. And let's see. At that point, his brother-in-law invaded Cilicia, which is on the northern part of the Mediterranean. We'll talk about Cilicia in the New Testament. But he invaded that and brought that into the tributary. But then he died in 556, and so we're 4 years removed. And he was followed by his infant son, who was then killed by conspirators, and they placed their man on the throne. And their man was a man named Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is going to reign the last 3 years. So there's 6 years between when Nebuchadnezzar dies, 6 years between when Nebuchadnezzar dies and when Nabonidus comes to the throne. And then Nabonidus will rule, for not quite 20 years. And he is the one who will be king at the time that Babylon falls. All right. So he comes to the throne. Well, when Nabonidus comes to the throne, he begins to make alliances with various nations. He makes alliances with the Medes, who Babylon had partnered with back when they ousted Assyria. But at the same time, the kingdom of Persia is beginning to grow. It's been a small kingdom up to this point, and now it's a growing kingdom. And particularly when a man named Cyrus comes to the throne, it really begins to grow, and he starts growing his kingdom in the other direction, like out towards India and to the north, and he begins to challenge the Medes, but not yet the Babylonians. And in one battle, he finally defeats the Medes so thoroughly that he just absorbs the entirety of their kingdom, which was the second largest kingdom in the world next to Babylon. So instantly, the Medo-Persian Empire is born, and all of a sudden, there's this empire that is larger than Babylon, I mean, just almost overnight, after he defeats him. And so, Nabonidus continues to make alliances ineffectively, because just about every alliance he makes, then the Medo-Persians come in. Libya was one of those, or Lydia, rather, was one of those, and just various ones. And the Medo-Persians just come in and just swallow them up. And they become a part of the Medo-Persian Empire. So basically, there's no power left but Babylon. Well, meanwhile, Nabonidus also has changed loyalties of the gods that he served. And the god who is served by most of the people in Babylon, he has spurned. And so he became very unpopular in the city of Babylon. And so he went to what was a secondary capital, south of there, and he left his son Belshazzar in Babylon. That's where we are when we come to chapter 5. Now, I know that's a lot of history. That's a lot going on. One of the reasons I think it's important to understand a little bit about that is because people will point to chapter 5 and say, that's not the king. Well, technically, you're correct. Nabonidus was the king. It is the son of the king, and he is basically the one who was left in Babylon to rule while his father spent most of his time in the alternative capital to the south. So all of that's happened between chapter 4 and chapter 5. And we open up chapter 5, and we're to the end of this thing. Right. Right. There's an indicator there. But I'm just saying, when people point to that as a criticism, there's enough history there. You can see what's going on. And so referring to him as the king is not inappropriate any more than referring to Herod as a king. Herod is a king, more like a local governor, but people did call him king. Well, the same thing's true of Belshazzar here in Daniel chapter 5. All right, so we open up Daniel chapter 5. We've got the son of the king there in Babylon. And what is particularly interesting as we're about to get into this chapter, is that the Medo-Persians have made significant gains already as they're coming up to Babylon. Babylon as an empire has been losing territory left and right. And they came up to the city of Babylon, and one of the things that they did is began digging channels to divert the path of the river to reduce the amount of water that was going into the city. And they would indeed use that path to get into the city and eventually take it over. But here in the city, what is Belshazzar doing? Have a party. Seems like a good time for a party. You got the strongest military power in the world that's taking territory all along. Your water supply is going down. They're coming in by way of siege. Let's have a party. And not only a party, how far does he go in this party, does it seem? Yeah, let's throw a big one, right? And maybe what he's doing is hearkening back to the days of glory. Let's go back to the days of Nebuchadnezzar and let's drink from his spoils of war. And so they bring, among those spoils, the vessels from the temple, and they're drinking and partying from those. And so, in the midst of all of that celebration, what disconcerting thing happens?
Right.
Okay. All right. Do you know that, it's interesting to me when you are observing language, English language, how many phrases come from the Bible? The world knows what the handwriting on the wall means. They don't know that it comes from Daniel, but they know what the phrase means. And I think it's always just a worthy observation when you go, hey, the world's still using, they would hate it if they knew it, but they're still using language from the scriptures. So here is this very obscure reference. There's a handwriting on the wall, and this is the only place that that comes from in history. So this finger appears, and it writes these things on the wall. And so Belshazzar, he says, I'll give the treasury away, you know, all the honor and the riches to anyone who can interpret what just happened here. So he calls in, and there's no one who can interpret it. And who brings up Daniel? One more time. The queen. Yes. The mother. All right. And she's a little bit older, and she goes, hey, you know, Nebuchadnezzar, there was a guy that he named, Belshazzar. He has the wisdom of the gods. And that's why he was named Belshazzar, is because he had the wisdom of the gods. And so bring him in, and maybe he will interpret. So he brings him in, and he says, I've heard of you, and look all the things that I'll do for you if you can interpret this. And what's Daniel's response, first of all, to that, to the offer? Keep it, but I'll still tell you what it means. Now, when he says, what does this mean? What is he asking? Is he asking what the words are? Like, what do these symbols mean? Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you would be. It wouldn't matter if it said ice cream up there. It would still be, it would freak you out. You would be like, somebody is writing, there's something writing on the wall here. It's not just that the words themselves are enigmatic. I don't know what these words mean. I know what those words mean, but I don't know what it means. You know, what's going on here? And so he tells him. And so the words mean numbered, weighed, and divided. And so, what's been numbered? Yeah. The numbering is the deeds of the people. You know, it's been counted up. You know, there's an accounting, there's a reckoning. It's been weighed and found wanting. You're not measuring up. And so divided. It's going to be torn away from you. Your kingdom's going to be torn away from you. And in spite of Daniel's refusal, he still goes on and says, put it on him, you know, put the purple on him and put the chain around his neck. But in spite of all that, the destruction still comes. Now, in interpreting that, before he interprets that, what does Daniel say about Nebuchadnezzar? And I think he indicates Nebuchadnezzar did, right? God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar listened. This great king, the greatest king of Babylon, listened. And here's Belshazzar. And I think that the insinuation is, you're nobody compared to Nebuchadnezzar. But he listened, and you did not. And so you're going to be taken down. And I also think that's fascinating, the way that Daniel speaks. Look at the difference between the way Daniel talks to Belshazzar and the way that he talked to Nebuchadnezzar. Do you see a distinct difference in the language and the verbiage? It's sort of like, I don't have any use for you. And it's not that he's just utterly disrespectful, but there's not the same sort of, I hate this. You know, it's sort of like, hey, this is what's coming. You wouldn't listen. You haven't listened. And so I think there's a difference between Nebuchadnezzar being open all along the way. And I think that's also borne out by the fact that God is willing to give Nebuchadnezzar opportunities to see and to know who he is and to respond. And here with Belshazzar, we're done. Okay, you're not listening. And so this is over and he's going to be destroyed. One of the points of the book of Daniel is to glorify God, to show who God is to men of great power. Here is one of the great powers, one of the builders of one of the wonders of the ancient world. And here they are brought down and they are destroyed. And history will tell you about that, right? You don't need the Bible to tell you that Babylon was destroyed. And in fact, that it was destroyed by the Medo-Persian Empire. God's story says, here's my part in that. I'm the one that called it. I'm the one who wrought it. And so you get to read the history, but the history's not saying, listen, there was this writing on the wall there in Babylon before. You know, the Persians aren't going to tell you about that. They don't even know about that. But God's saying, you know that great event that you read in your history books? That's me. I did that. And so I think that's a fascinating opportunity for us to see God working. And that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar said. It is God who rules in the kingdoms. God is the one raising and lowering kingdoms. And all of that is proven here in chapter 5. Yes, sir.
He's talking to Nebuchadnezzar. It sounds very
right. Right. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well, that's the fall of the Babylonian Empire. Chapter 6, we come into chapter 6, and now we have a local ruler again, whose name is Darius or Darius. And so there would be a king, there would be a ruler over all the Medo-Persian Empire with this name. This is not that guy. Cyrus would have been the man over all of the Medo-Persian Empire. Well, it's also pertinent to note that Babylon has not utterly been destroyed yet. Babylon the city has been overtaken, but Babylon the empire, there's still residual work to do, we might say, to continue. Remember, this is the son of the king, not the king himself. So that's important to the first question, which is, how long has Daniel been in captivity at this point? Is 66, 67 years, been on 606, 605 BC. If it's 605, then it's 66 years. And so there's still a few more years before that 70 years is up, and we'll get to that later in the lesson. So 66 years he's been there. How old does that make Daniel possibly? Yeah. He's in his 80s. Almost certainly, if he was 16 years old, he's 82 years old. And so, he's an older man. And so here, he is with all of the conviction of his youth still there, at 82 years of age. And I think that's a wonderful thing to keep in mind. As we go into this story, we have some officials who are seeking grounds for accusations against Daniel. And what is their cause for that? What's their motive? Yes. Yeah, so Daniel, again, is rising to the top. Just as he has in previous times, now we have a totally new administration, and he's putting people in place, and here is Daniel still currying favor through his wisdom and no doubt through his character. He is rising up in the ranks. And so through rank jealousy, is really the motive behind what they're doing.
They're not gonna try their own character.
Oh, no. Well, you know, sometimes you just got to admit you don't have it. And I think that's what they're saying, is we can't beat him that way. So what do they go for? What's the only charge they can bring against him? Yeah. The only way we're going to find it, the only thing Daniel, we can consistently say about Daniel is he follows that law. What a commendation. To note that your enemies would say, the only thing we can find wrong with this guy is he just always follows the Bible. And so if we're going to accuse him, that's where we'll have to accuse him. Well, the ordinance that they pass through is that it would be punishable by death to call upon anyone but the ruler for, you know, for petition, to petition gods of any other sort. And so they do this knowing that Daniel does this. Daniel, of course, goes to his upper room, and what does he do there? He opens the window. He opens the shutters, as it were, where he's visible and prays. Why does he do that? Because he always had, and why had he always done that? Yeah, do you remember when we talked about Solomon's prayer in 1 Kings chapter 8? Whenever the people are taken away into captivity, if they'll turn back in this direction, would you hear their prayers? And so that's exactly what Solomon had asked, and it's exactly what Daniel's doing, is turning back. He is following exactly what Solomon said. And so he is devoted in that. And of course they know he's devoted in that. So he continues to do what he always had. But I think it's important to note, it's not just a random habit that Daniel, it is a thought out habit that Daniel has. Trevor. Right. And so, the initial, it's not required of him, but he's been doing that. And I think that shows the thoroughness in which he's doing that. And then when this comes, it's like, well, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to change what I'm doing. And I think that's a key element as well, is that he continues the same devotion that he always had. That's right. He puts his trust in God. And of course he's going to be rewarded for that. What's Darius's reaction when he realizes what all's happened? He realizes the trap that's been set. Exactly. He does not want this in any way. That was their thought. That was not his thought. When he agreed to this law. Now, having said that, even though he doesn't agree to, that's not the reason he agrees to it. It is maybe some just consequences of, he did make a foolish decision. He did make a very prideful decision, and it's resulted in this. And so, but there is humility now, or at least there is remorse now that we see on the part, of Darius. And so what is his response to that? I mean, yeah, he does everything he can. The law is the law, and there are bigger things than Darius at play here. And so he cannot undo that. But he says he will spend one night in the den of lions. And we'll pick up there and then look at some of the visions of Daniel on Sunday. Appreciate everybody's good attention.